This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy. Yeah.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Perfectly Mentored. I'm your host, Jason Portnoy. My guest today is Phil Town. He's an expert investor, three-time New York Times bestselling author, and founder of Rule Number One Investing, the largest value investing training company in the world. Phil offers his expert opinion and shares his insights and rules for investing regularly with followers through his social media platforms and his podcast. After accurately predicting the past two crashes, he predicted a larger crash, which was just around the corner once again, and started pulling out of the market, and now he's sitting on cash ready to take advantage of the down market. Fast forward to the COVID-19 outbreak and the global pandemic, Phil has continued to share his advice with his large following on how they should be navigating these difficult times to maximize their wealth. Phil, such a pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's great to see you again. Good to be here, man.
You know, we were just chatting right offline, but I want the listeners to understand just a little intro. I heard Phil for the first time speak on CNBC's The Millionaire Inside, which was almost 14, 15 years ago at this point. And I loved what he had to say. Right after that, I ended up buying his book, Rule Number One. And in my very early 20s, started to invest, or at least learn how to invest. So I want to thank you personally in front of everyone. To my intro to investing. And although I'm still a heavy amateur and got ways to go, at least I'm in the game. So thank you for that.
It's a pleasure. I'm really glad you're doing it and really glad you're doing a podcast. The mentoring podcast is such a great idea. I hope you just continue to do this work. It's great stuff.
I appreciate that. As long as people like you keep coming on and delivering value and helping people, I'll keep doing this, I promise.
Very cool, man.
Let's talk about Rule Number One and the background behind it and why the principles behind it have held true for at least the last 15 years. It's based off Warren Buffett's rule, right?
It is, and that really kind of comes from Ben Graham, who was the first hedge fund manager who started the whole idea of doing a hedge fund back in the early 30s. And came up with this basic notion that you really shouldn't, if you really want to make a lot of money, you have to avoid risk, which is, it's kind of counterintuitive, right? I mean, the Securities Exchange Commission in the United States believes that in order to make a lot of money, you have to take a lot of risk. And they associate high returns with risk almost automatically. And yet here's Ben Graham, who made in today's dollars, billions of dollars, and his student Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who've made billions of dollars, and then so many other really successful investors who've made millions and millions of dollars, including me, who go at it with the idea that really you're not going to end up with a lot of money if you're taking a lot of risk, any more than you would in real estate. You know, you wouldn't expect you're going to end up with a ton of money if you're doing these wild, crazy real estate deals, trying to develop stuff. You know, maybe you'll win, maybe you'll lose. I got a neighbor who's a real estate developer that had a $1 billion project going and just got wiped out in 2008, all the way to zero. I mean, it's just, you don't want a lot of risk. And that's the fundamental that makes us rather boring, I guess, is that we're trying to make sure we're buying stuff that we really understand and that is going to do well. And we wait around forever for the thing to go on sale, you know, and just like, okay, we're going to buy old Bowflex machines and sell them on eBay, but we're not going to buy them for $800. We're going to buy them for $50 at somebody's garage sale. You know, that's how we play.
Take a step back for a second. I think your story is fascinating. You were a river guide. How did you get started into this whole and as becoming a big investor?
Yeah, really the path to becoming a successful investor leads through the Grand Canyon in my case. And it was that, I was down there for about 10 years. I was living in Flagstaff, Arizona, working for a company called Arizona Raft Adventures that is still run by the Elliott family. Fabulous people. If you ever want to go on a river trip in the Grand Canyon, go with those guys. They're great. And I was leading a trip that had Outward Bound trustees on it. And we were paddling the canyon. And I got about a week down into it. And we came to the biggest rapid on the river, this rapid called Crystal, that if you're running boats that you can row or you've got a motor, you can walk people around it. You can pull in, walk them around. But if you're paddling, you got to have the people on the boat. So these guys had to paddle it. And we ended up getting sucked out into the middle of the river over toward the 35-foot drop that exists on the sort of center left side. And there was nowhere to go except over this waterfall or take the boat all the way to the far left side of the river and crash into the wall. And that's what we did. We just went over there and hit the wall. And it was just this huge, huge wave that took us sideways and around the drop that, I mean, I'd been down there 40 times. I didn't know you could go around it. Nobody's been crazy enough to actually do that on purpose. So we got around it and one of the guys got out of the boat and when we got to the beach and threw up. And so I knew he was pretty excited. And this other guy grabbed me by the shoulders and shaking me. And he said, "You saved my life. You saved my life." And he decided for the rest of the trip that he was going to teach me to be an investor. It's like, I thought I was going to get this big tip, right? And he was like, no, man, I'm going to teach you to fish, you know? And I'm like, I don't want to fish. I just want a big tip.
Yeah.
I mean, I was making $4,000 a year, right, Jason? I'm like, yeah. I could use a tip. So he basically said, come and visit me out in San Diego, California. And I did later that winter, just because I was on the road and thought I'd drop by. And I got sucked in. I got sucked right into this guy's view that he got from Buffett and Munger and Graham. And I became an apprentice to this guy for about a year and learned to do this stuff. And then I started with about $1,000 and then I made a lot of money.
Is that why it's so important for you to give back? And that's why you're taking on that role now and trying to, I guess, scale what he did for you.
Yeah. I wish I could say it was really my intention. It was more that students, or not students, but people who had listened to me speak about this or read my books, started pressing me, particularly this guy named Earl Davis, who's was kind of breaking the boundaries at the Air Force. He's a black guy who became an Air Force pilot, and his brothers are all like incredible pilots, and he married a woman that was also breaking boundaries and, you know, gender boundaries at the Air Force Academy. And so he's like this superstar guy, and he saw me speak, gosh, about the time you were watching me on Millionaire Next Door or that whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I was speaking to a big crowd. I mean, 15,000 people about this. And Earl said he just decided right then he was going to learn how to do this and he was going to teach it. And he came to me and said, I want to teach this stuff. And I think you should let other people learn it. And if you'll teach me how to teach it, I'll teach it. And one thing led to another. We started just building this program that has just taken off. I mean, we're teaching 10,000 people a year now how to do this kind of investing. And it really wasn't in my mind to do it. I'm sort of sit at home and I'm an invest and stay in my home. And I'm the guy that if there's a party, I'm the guy over in the corner. guy, you know, I'm not out to change the world. And yet here we are. We find ourselves really excited by the possibility that we can help people create generational wealth, and it's not rocket science. I mean, you've learned about it. It's great.
It's funny to hear you describe yourself as such, because I've seen you on stage. I've seen you sell in an hour, and I've seen people wave up papers to sign up for you, and then people bum rush the stage in order to get to you. So it's funny to hear you describe yourself as like that introvert when I see the Phil Town on stage, right?
You know, it's funny. It's like, I'm sure there's a lot of actors that are like me, you know, they're very outgoing in front of a camera or something. And then they feel very shy about the rest of it. And, you know, it's just funny. It's an extrovert gets a lot of energy from being in front of people. It drains me to the core. I mean, I get done with a speech like that and they take me back to the green room and I have to just slump. Like I'm cooked. And then when this is the exotic and exciting life of a public speaker is they take me back to the hotel if I can't catch a flight home. And I like curl up in the fetal position and watch TV and get room service. That's the maximum amount of energy I have left. So I'm definitely an introvert, man.
But you're in a position though, where you put yourself on the line, right? You're telling people to invest money, put money out there. Does that scare you at all? Does it scare you that like people could, you know, it's not like, hey, go market yourself or hey, you know, go take this type of lesson. It's here, take your money, take your savings and go invest it. Does that ever like, is that do you become empathetic to the people you're talking to? Does that ever cross your mind of like, what if they don't listen to me?
This is why you are so good at your podcast and so good at what you do, because in all the interviews I've ever given in the last 15 years, and there's been a lot of them, nobody's ever asked that question before. And it's a very perceptive question. I mean, if you're going to teach people things, you don't want to teach people things that where they can hurt themselves, right? And no question that some of the things we teach people, there's the possibility of injury, right? If you were to go learn how to snowboard and I was to teach you to snowboard, even if you do it kind of right, you still could get hurt, right? It's not in the teaching, in other words. There's just potential for damage and things that have risk to them. But I don't lose sleep on it, because this style of investing or this strategy of investing has been proven now for 90 years to be effective, whether we're in a depression or inflationary period or World War II or Vietnam era or all the last 30 years. It's still working. And the reason it works is because we focus on not losing money. It's the entire focus of this thing is to not lose money. And we let the making money take care of itself. We really don't think about it much. It's more just, please, you know, don't make a mistake. That's what I think about. And that's what I try to teach everybody, right? And so we end up, when we're teaching this stuff, we end up with basically a four-step checklist. And the first step is the most critical. And that is, do you see yourself as capable of understanding this business well enough that you can make some decisions about it, right? In other words, do you know it? I like to think of it like, I like to know a business well enough that it's the same as in my neighborhood here in a county that's going to double in the next 10 years. If I buy a house here and buy it at a great price and rent it out, I know I'm going to be renting it for more money in 10 years. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. That's the level of certainty I want to have before I put money in a company. So if you follow the strategy that Ben Graham laid out there, your entire focus of your intention is not buying something you don't understand.
But how does that value type investing play with like, or I guess the better question is, when will value investing come into vogue again versus growth investing like Amazon, Google, Apple, and all that?
Well, I'm not a value investor. I'm gonna take exception to that. I'm gonna tell you what Buffett says, and that is that really all good investing is value investing. Because investing is different than speculating. Investing is buying something you know is worth $10 and you buy it for $5. That's investing, right? So you go down and to a garage sale and buy a mink coat that nobody wants anymore because they're out of style. You pay $20 for it and you sell it on eBay for $300. That's investing. That's not speculating. You know you're going to make money. And so it's not a question of sort of figuring out what kind of problems you're going to end up with when you end up in a company. It's a question of knowing that you have nailed down the value of this thing so solidly that you are going to make money. So if I were to look at Amazon, which is a big growth company, I would buy Amazon in a screaming heartbeat. It wouldn't be against any of the checklists I've got. It's just a question of what price can I pay? And it was getting down there in that COVID thing in March. And I thought, holy smokes, I might have a shot at getting this at the price I'm willing to pay. Same thing with Facebook. Same thing with Google. In fact, I've owned Google in the past and I wished I owned Facebook when I just didn't understand it well enough when it came out. So I'm going to say that I'm probably not a value investor. I'm just an investor. And investing to me is buying something far less than what it's worth. And really knowing what it's worth. I mean, being sure that I know what it's worth and that someday it'll be priced at that price.
I want to talk about the current situation we're in right now. You predicted a bunch of crashes, but this is different, right? We're in a different time. How is the current market different than what we've seen in past crashes or past economic downturns?
Right. So we are now in a kind of a new era where the central banks in the world have decided that they can intervene in the marketplace without some sort of drastic economic disaster happening, right? So they're trying to avoid economic disaster, and that was what they were doing in the last major downturn by dropping interest rates to zero and the United States printing $4 trillion. They did something similar in China, something similar in Europe. And they avoided a depression, which might have been caused by a freeze up in the financial system. And today they have gotten so comfortable with this idea that we're in the process in the United States, and I think Canada is going to be doing something similar, of simply replacing money that's being lost. So if people have lost their jobs and if investments have gone south, the federal government is simply printing money and putting it out there in the form of support payments and zero rate interest loans, and they're buying back bonds, and in Japan they're buying stock, they're purchasing their equivalent of the S&P 500 with the central banks. So they've kind of come to the conclusion, and I think a little bit of this conclusion is being driven by being painted into a corner from prior actions. They've come to the conclusion that they have to do this, or the whole economy falls off the table and people are really damaged. So then the question for an investor is, well, if they're going to relentlessly push zero interest rates or even negative interest rates, does that really change the value of things out there? Should I pay more for things because we're in a zero interest rate environment, which is what many, many fund managers do. They are willing to pay more because interest rates are low. And there's a certain logic to that. But in our view, and in the view of Buffett and Bill Gates and Charlie Munger, this is an aberration and it's a short-term event. And at some point here in the near future, we're going to have an economic storm that has been in part created by trying to avoid previous economic storms. And when that economic storm happens, we want to be in cash to go out there in that storm and just have the ability when it happens, it's going to rain gold. And it's going to rain gold for a short time. It doesn't do it for long. But for a short time, the markets will be overwhelmed by fear. And that fear will drive big professional investors out of the market. And they will put on so many great companies, including maybe Amazon and Apple and Facebook and Google. Phenomenal companies may go on sale out of just the overwhelming fear that happens out there. And what we want to do is be the guys who are buying in that fear. We want to be the people who are providing stability to the markets. And so there's a real place for us to be there in order to support the markets. If nobody does what we're going to do, markets just keep going down to zero, right? Until somebody actually has the courage to step in. So me, all my students, all the people Buffett has ever trained, the guys like Monash Pabrai, Guy Spier, Money, are all ready to go deep when the market presents those opportunities for us. But we just don't have a crystal ball. We know it'll happen. We just don't have a crystal ball. We saw the impact of COVID, very, very severe impact in just a matter of a few weeks on the stock market as fear rose up and like, oh my God, the economy is going to shut down. And then in comes the Federal Reserve, in comes the Congress to just pour money into this economy and confidence returns to the markets. Well, the next time this happens, it may not be so easy to stop the drop. And eventually, we're going to have an opportunity to buy stuff that's cheap. And that's all we're waiting for, really, is an opportunity to buy things that are cheap.
I think I've heard you say, you know, you could go outside when it rains with a thimble, or you could go outside with a bathtub, right? Exactly. You want to be the guy that goes outside with the bathtub.
Right. Charlie Munger says that our investing strategy is passive-aggressive. We're massively passive for long periods of time when we don't have opportunities. And then when we do, we get extremely aggressive. We go out with a pickup truck. We go out with the biggest truck we can get to load up on it. And we don't go out like you're taking money to Las Vegas that you know you can lose. We don't play that. It's every penny we've got to go into the market. The last time that happened, that we really had that opportunity in a major way, was 2009. And I went on CNBC and said, okay, we're loading up the truck. And we had a group of students in our first class in Singapore that we selected 10 companies in that class and built a portfolio with $100,000 of paper trading money in that portfolio of, you know, of 10% per company. And then we had another $100,000 of paper money in the S&P 500. And we just let it run for 10 years. And when we wrapped it up, 2018, the S&P portfolio had done extremely well, 13% per year compounded, and it had tripled, right? It had gone from 100 to about 300. But the stock portfolio went from 100,000 to 1.257 million and compounded at 32% per year. So it was four times larger than the S&P 500 produced at one of the best eras of the S&P 500 ever. So we do go out with a big, huge truck. Yeah.
So given all that, what are some good rules to follow right now for financial success following what's going on? You know, I guess, especially if you feel like you have a lot of investors who feel like they missed the boat on that March dip, right when the pandemic happened. So what's your advice to them?
Well, the first thing is you didn't miss the boat. I wasn't buying very much. Neither was Warren Buffett. Almost nobody that we know who's invests our way thought that a lot of things went on sale, even though the Dow went down almost 40%. That's how high price things are right now. A 40% drop wasn't enough to put stuff on sale. So there will be another opportunity. And right now, I think the best thing you can do is study how the best investors invest. Jason, you know, it's not rocket science. It really is simple. It doesn't make it easy, but it's really simple. And I can lay it out there for you. But if you were to read Buffett's letters that are online from Berkshire Hathaway chairman's letters, it's an education all by itself. If you read, Guy Spier wrote a fantastic book called The Education of a Value Investor. So Guy calls himself a value investor. And Monash Prabhai wrote a fabulous book called The Dondo, D-H-A-N-D-H-O, Dondo Investor. Read my book, Rule Number One. There's a lot of great books out there, and you can self-learn. I mean, it's not something you can't learn from a book. We had a 14-year-old kid that was shoveling horse manure out of our barn who read the book and started doing really well with a paper trading account, and his uncle gave him $5,000 and said, "Hey, man, you're doing better than my advisors." And I'll tell you, it really is straightforward if you apply yourself to do four things. Number one, be sure you're only looking at companies you're capable of understanding. And that might mean you're not looking at hundreds of companies. You're looking at a six or seven companies total. You know, for me, I might be pretty comfortable looking at Chipotle Mexican Grill and not really comfortable at all looking at Intel, right, or something like that. So I can understand burritos. So you want things you're capable of understanding, and that's all you need is a handful. And then second, you want to make sure that they have a big moat. And so you'll have to learn what's that, right? What is it that can protect a company for a decade or two from competition? Third, you want management with integrity. And man, I'll tell you, I don't have an answer for that one, except pray that they have integrity. When the going gets tough, they don't turn traitor on you, you know? Because many of them do. So we watch management very closely. By the way, that's something that's got to get changed. It's just horrendous what boards of directors do and what management does to owners of companies, to the environment, to all kinds of stuff. So we want to try to have management with integrity and talent. And then we want to buy when it's on sale. So you basically have to have the first three things in order to have an idea what this thing is worth, right? If I don't understand the business, how the heck am I going to know what to pay for it? So you go those three things, and those produce what we call a wonderful business. And the fourth thing is you buying it on sale, and you figure out what's this thing worth, and then you wait. And that's where the patience comes from. That's where our investing style is just bordering on sloth. I mean, I don't do anything most of the time. It's just, I go ride my horses, you know, just goofing off.
But then when you do go in, you go all in.
All in. All in. Yep, absolutely. I want to get all in as soon as I can. I don't love being in cash, especially if they're going to go out there and create massive inflation someday, which they may. Then cash becomes a real liability. But right now, it's I think the best place to be. So if I was talking to somebody, I'm not your advisor. I can't give you personal advice, but I could sure tell you what my opinion is. And in my opinion, you want to be in cash. I mean, in my opinion, follow what Buffett's doing. The guy's $140 billion in cash. He has three times more cash on hand now than he's ever had in his history. So here's somebody very patient. Charlie Munger's in cash. Munger's 95, and he doesn't buy even green bananas. I mean, this guy is, but he's in cash, waiting patiently at 95 years old for an opportunity to strike. So I love what Charlie says. He says, we like to do our fishing when the fish are in the barrel. And he said, and then we like to drain the water. So we don't want to take risk. We kind of back to that at the beginning of this whole thing, Jason, is that we want to have companies that are no-brainers. They really are $10 bills for $5. They're obviously a $10 bill for $5. All we need is patience for it to be worth $5 or $10 down the road, and we'll double our money. And that's what we intend to do.
So I guess I mean, I'll ask this question, but I'm pretty sure the answer is sit on cash right now. But what stocks and businesses should you be paying attention to right now? Or are you paying attention to right now?
For sure. And the answer is you're looking for companies where there's fear or industries where there's fear, because you're not going to buy a wonderful business on sale unless there's fear. And that's because you're going to be buying it from fund managers in New York who are not stupid and they're not irrational. They're only going to sell it if they know they got to get out of the building for the short term in order to preserve their jobs, right? They got to stay with the market. And so there has to be fear. They're not going to put something on sale. You know, it's worth $200. They're not going to sell it to you for $100 for no reason. So you've got to have fear. And so the fear might be, a past example with Chipotle Mexican Grill, for example, is that people started getting E. coli for a couple of months. And that kind of a problem often lasts with other companies, other restaurants, maybe 3 years or so. And so we waited for the stock to get down into the 200s and started buying it up, knowing with huge level of confidence that that would sometime be fixed in the future, right? So fear drives out the fund managers, and we're only to step in some certain cases. We bought some oil companies in, or not oil companies, but the guys that did the drilling wells in the Gulf of Mexico when that big well blew up with BP, and every single drilling rig operator out there went on sale, even if they had nothing to do with it. So we love fear that doesn't actually affect that individual business. And right now, the fear is loaded up on anything to do with travel. So you have airlines, you have cruise ships, hotels. These are all gigantic industries that have been sold off massively by the fund managers because they know that it might be a long, long time before those recover. Well, if you could figure out how long it's going to take them to recover, for example, you could maybe say, well, you know, might be 5 years before the airlines recover. And if you're willing to wait 5 years, you're doing something that no fund manager is willing to do. They're not going to wait 5 years to double their money. But if you did, you'd be making 15% a year, just like that, right? So you have to look at these companies and you say, okay, could they go bankrupt? And the answer is right now, yeah, they all could. If this thing just keeps rolling, they probably won't, but we don't like to take chances. Remember, we don't like risk. So you could look at banks right now. They're under a lot of pressure, and there are some banks which are super good banks, like the best rated banks in the world, and they're on sale. So that would be a place I might look. Right. I mean, Warren Buffett right now is very publicly buying more Bank of America, for example. So if that's something you feel capable of understanding, you could look at that. So the idea is you're looking at specific industries which are undergoing a great wave of fear that kicks out the fund managers. And then if you can look and say, look, it's really clearly this is going to be over in 3 years, then you can step in when a fund manager won't. 3 years is forever. I mean, they might as well just quit their jobs if they're going to wait 3 years. So 3 years is too far for a fund manager, but it's just right for us. And if you can see that far down the road on a great company, like we could say on Chipotle and other companies we bought, yeah, you're going to make a lot of money.
So you'd still buy stocks today, even though you're saying like, hang on, wait till you could go outside with your truck?
Yep, absolutely. Because we're not really, we look at the market to get an idea of what the weather is that we're in. Right. I mean, if you know you're in a lot of storms, you know, you may not want to go make a picnic outside or something and hope for good weather. So and basically what that does is it tells us, wow, we've got a really elevated stock market price in general. So we shouldn't be surprised that it's really hard to find great companies that are on sale. We can find great companies, but they're not on sale. So we're building a watch list, right? We have a watch list that we want to buy. And then if anything on that watch list should go on sale, then we're totally willing to buy it regardless of what price the market's at. Really does not matter. So, you know, we bought companies before the COVID thing. We bought companies during the COVID thing. And we're taking little pieces of companies right now.
Yep. Just as important as when to buy is also when to sell, right? You didn't make money or you didn't lose money until you actually pulled the second trigger or you pulled the trigger a second time. What advice do you have for beginners listening on how to make decisions on when to pull that trigger, when to sell? Because you gave phenomenal advice on when to get into the market. But if you sit on it and ride it into the next storm, and you don't get out, it really just, it's void, right? It doesn't really, it cancels each other out. So what advice do you have on understanding on how to pull that trigger, the sell trigger?
Well, the first thing to understand is that when we buy a company, let me put it like this to you. If your family loves hamburgers, let's say you love Big Macs, and you're going and buying Big Macs every week, you want Big Macs. You want the price of Big Macs to go up or down?
Down.
Down, right? And let's say you do a lot of driving and you really like to travel. You want the price of gas to go up or down?
Down.
Down. All right. So here's the tough question. If you're going to be buying stocks and you buy them, do you want the price of those stocks to go up or down?
If you're buying?
You bought them. Yeah.
You bought them, now, you want it to go up.
Right. That's what everybody says. Right. But we don't. We want them to go down. Just because we're consuming. We're consuming. You're a young guy, man. You don't need to be selling companies. What you need to be is consuming companies. Okay. So the first thing you want to think is, I'm going to buy this and I'm going to hold this forever. This is a wonderful business. Unless the story changes, this is going to be my business the way Microsoft is Bill Gates' business forever. That's how you want to look at it. Now, the story can change and then you're going to get rid of it. But if the story isn't changing, selling it is not what you're looking to do. So you were saying you write it up and then you write it down at the next one, like 10 years from now. Right. You do. You actually do write it down. And people started moaning like crazy the last time. I think 2008, we were at Buffett. We're listening to Buffett do his annual thing. And somebody said, Coca-Cola's going down like a brick. You know, why aren't you selling it? Because he had ridden it up, right, to like 70-something a share. And now it was coming down and coming down and coming down in 2008. And Buffett said, I hope it goes down 50% more. And there was a loud moan going through the audience because these guys are all thinking in terms of what is the value of what I own today? And this value is decreasing every day, every day, every day it's going down. And that's not how we look at it. We look at it just the way you'd look at owning a rental house that you plan on owning for your retirement, okay? And the fact that real estate is going up and down it's not in your mind you're going to trade this thing. I'm going to sell it now and I'm going to buy it back. You know, it's like, no, you're going to hold it. The rents are providing you with cash flow, and that cash flow increasing over time makes that real estate more valuable. And eventually the market will catch up with it at some point. And meanwhile, those rents just keep going up. Okay. So here's Chipotle Mexican Grill going up, 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 up. It gets up, I don't know, 200 or something. And then here comes 2008 and it drops down to $55 a share. All right. And we can step in and buy it right there. And then Chipotle continues to make free cash flow, continues in other words, to have huge profitability on the rent. And instead of giving me the rent money that I've got to then reinvest, it just keeps reinvesting it itself in its own restaurants and builds more restaurants. And those produce more cash flow. And so not only am I investing initially, but then Chipotle is investing for me over time. So if I can get a company that will invest my money and the increases in my money, the compounding increase in my money, and invest it successfully over time, I don't want to touch that thing, Jason. And Chipotle manages to do that to the tune of 20 to 30% a year. They're making on the money I leave in there. Apple is knocking out 30% a year on the money that I leave in there. Man, I mean, there's just about no amount of money you could offer me to get out of a business that'll do that, right? So in general, we're not looking to get out in general. Now, that said, if you are out to make a lot of money faster, then you are more like I was when I started and like Warren Buffett was when he started, where we are out to keep the velocity of money high. And then we want to avoid having that dip happen. We are, I'm going to contradict myself now. We are going to unload this thing. And what we do is we keep track of the real value of that business. So when I bought it, if I said I'm buying $10 of value and I'm paying $5, when that goes back to its value, that value will be at least $10. And if it takes 2 or 3 years, it might be $12 or $13, right? But when it goes back to that value, which it will someday if I've done my job right and priced it properly, got the right value, when it goes back to that, then from that point on, the velocity of my growth of my money will slow down to whatever the growth rate is in that company. So if I buy a company like See's Candy super cheap and it's only growing at 4%, I'm going to buy a $10 bill for $5. 2 years later, it's back up to $10. And from then on, it's going to grow at 4%. So in 2 years, I've compounded money at 36% a year. But from now on, it's going to be 4%. All right, I'm going to sell that. And the way I'm going to sell it is I'm going to ideally put call options out there to be called away and make a little extra on it. And I'm going to be called away at around 120% of what I think the value is. My values are usually pretty conservative, so I tend to get up there. So I'm going to sell at around 120 if I'm trying to build a life, if I'm trying to get financially independent, retire early, have a great retirement. Then I'm going to be much more aggressive about this. I'm going to work harder and try to find something else to put that money in. Have I completely contradicted myself? Oh, are you okay?
No, I get it. I get what you're saying. I guess it just depends on your mindset of where you're at and what you want to do.
Yeah. You're working with $10,000. You better get aggressive. You're working with $10 million. You do what I just said. You just stay long and enjoy the benefits.
So let's break this down into different tiers, right? If you're in your 20s and just getting started for the first time, what's the best course of action to take in your investment? And then I guess in your 40s, and then I guess if you're like 40s with a small family or about to retire, let's do those three tiers.
Okay. So I'm going to take exactly the opposite tack of almost any financial advisor. They're going to tell you if you're in your 20s, hey man, you put your money away and forget about it for 30 years and you're going to be wealthy, right? Yeah, you will. If you can keep investing through all the ups and downs in the market, when everybody else is running for the hills, you're going to keep putting money into the stock market. Oh, and by the way, you're going to stay with that job that you don't like, that one. You're going to stay in that job. You're going to stick with it. You're going to keep doing 9 to 5. You're going to grind, and you're going to grind for the next 30 years. And that financial advisor will be telling you the truth. If you do that corporate life or whatever it is, 30 years later, you will have stacked up enough money to retire fairly comfortably, okay? Not going to set the world on fire, but you're going to be all right if you want that life. Many people don't want that life. Many people want a life of financial freedom where you might not be rich, but you get to do what you want to do, right? You want to be a missionary in Africa, you can go do it. So that life requires more aggressiveness, and you should take that aggressiveness as young as you can. And the reason for that is because of the power of compounding money that is just overwhelmingly amazing, that the money you start putting away right now starts to compound at faster and faster rates of impact on the dollars until that money starts to look like a hockey stick and going straight up in terms of the amount of money you have there. By way of illustrating that, a friend of mine has got this dumb dog. People are going to hate me. I love dogs and I would do this too, okay? But I got money. This guy's a fireman, okay? And he doesn't have any money and he just had a baby and they're struggling. And he's got this stupid puppy that shoved his paw through a window. And instead of just having somebody to sort of fix it up, they took it to the university vet clinic and they paid $2,500 to get this dog fixed. All right. This is $2,500 he had to borrow from his mom who works as a housekeeper. All right, that $2,500, if he had just gotten his hands on that money, done something else with the dog. I'm sorry, dog lovers, but I'm just doing an illustration here. If he had taken that $2,500 and invested it at 15% a year, which is, as you know, we teach is your minimum acceptable rate of return, he would double that $2,500. Let's say he's 20 years old. So over the next 50 years, he's going to double that $2,500 10 times. All right. So he gets every 5 years, he doubles it and he's got 50 years to go. So is that right? 10 times, 10 doubles, 2,500 goes to 2.5. Let's see. Well, it goes to 5,000, 10, 20, 40, 80, 160, 320, 640, 1.2, 1.3 million, 2.6 million. The $2,500 that he's not thinking anything about because it's just $2,500 He doesn't know how to invest, so he doesn't think about compounding. Becomes 2.6 million. But check out what happens in those last years, right? The last 5 years, it went from 1.3 to 2.6. The last 10 years, it went from, like, you know, 650 to 2.6. So the sooner you can get going on that compounding curve, the more massively will be the impact. So if I say, if you're in that young cohort, then you want to get going on it and you want to get aggressive. I would come to our class and I'll teach you how to do options trades, and you can crank it with $1,000 and just go hard on doing options the way casinos gamble, right? They don't gamble. They're the house side of the thing. House, that's money. The side we're going to take. Yeah, it's house money. So that's what I would do in the 20s. In the 30s, now you got kids, you're thinking about college education. Losing money starts to become more problematic. But if ideally by this time you're working a job that's starting to put away some bucks, you want to keep your bad debt low. You want to maximize the good debt right now because you're paying 2 to 3% interest rates. So you maximize that debt and invest when you otherwise might have been buying the house, right? I would be investing. I would have a pile of cash sitting here right now, leveraged up the house at 2%, 2.5%, and I would be waiting for this thing to crater. And I would have a list of 10 companies, and when it does, I'm putting 10% into each one of them, and I'm going to forget about them for a decade. And by the time I'm 40, I'm going to be a millionaire. Okay? So that's I would do that in the 30s. And then in the 40s, I would say you're going to have the problem of paying for kids' college, and I would solve that problem by telling you, I paid for my kids to go to some of the best universities in the country, and I wish I didn't. I really wish I didn't. The education that they get, you can get that education in a community college. And what they really get is you're paying for a lot of networking, is exactly what you're paying for, and having a really cool looking thing on your resume. And the question is whether that's worth your retirement as their parents, right? You want to do great for your kids, but you also want to take care of yourself. So I would be very careful about having the kids go off to some $30,000, $40,000 a year school that I really can't afford. If I'm not sure I'm going to have a good retirement, I'm not financially independent, what am I doing helping my kids to pay for a $40,000 a year education when they could be going to community college for free? And I went to community colleges. Okay, I flunked out of one of them, but that was why I was not trying real hard. And the other one I did well in, and I did it because I was older, and I went back to school and I sat in the front row and I studied. And I went from there on to the University of California. And I will tell you, the community college was better. It was a better education. I learned more. I had better teachers. They paid more attention to me, smaller classes. So don't be all enamored with the idea. This is a big problem for a lot of people. It's like, oh, you know, we got to pay all this money for college. BS. It doesn't make that much difference. Go get a community college education. If you find something you really love to get into it. And if it takes 2 more years of college, great. If it takes 2 years of trade school, go do that. And remember that, you know, a lot of the most famous people in the country didn't finish college. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. Come on. I mean, these guys did pretty well. You're not restricted if you're going to go out and live the life you want to live. And the way to live the life you want to live is by becoming financially independent. And everybody can do that. No question about it. So in your 40s, I would say, okay, now you've got to start really paying attention to long-term investing. You want to get money into the market at the right time, which means you want to have the cash available so you don't get it locked up. Again, don't get it all locked up in real estate. Don't get it locked up in college educations. Have it available as a lump to be able to put in. And right now it's being invested in, you know, money market accounts and stuff. But the day will come within the next couple of years. And when that happens, people who are doing what I'm doing, in my opinion, will have an opportunity to get very wealthy. And people who don't are going to find themselves pounded down and going through another 10, 15 year period where those, you know, index funds and mutual funds just, you know, struggle to come back to zero, come back to where they were.
What about retiring? People who are ready to retire now.
All right. So here's the most fun thing about this. If you learn how to, let's say you've learned how to do this and you're now retiring, what would you do that's different? Well, the main thing that you do that's different is you are much more focused on just leaving things where they are. So you're just paying attention to the companies that you own, and you let them produce that cash flow, which then causes the company ultimately to grow in value, maybe over the next 5 years, maybe 10 or whatever. And you can sell off some shares as it goes along. Many of these companies buy back stock and give you a greater ownership position, which you can sell off to bring yourself back to your original percentage. Many of them provide dividends, and which you can use for cash flow. So I would be real excited to own a portfolio of companies which will do well, whether it's a recession or a depression or inflation. These are the kind of things that a wonderful business can handle, all three of them in one business. So if we get into real trouble, you know, I mean, Coca-Cola is a classic example for 110 years. It's been through all of the ups and the downs, the inflation, the deflation, the wars, all of that, and just keeps on chugging. That's kind of the kind of company you want. And so a lot of people made it through the Depression because they owned companies like Coca-Cola and they provided dividends. They lived on those dividends. And then ultimately the company came back to value. So I would say if you already know this stuff, then you would also probably be doing a little bit of trading on the side for fun. And probably a tenth of your portfolio would be traded to create cash flow to live on. And if you don't have that, then you're in a situation where, let's go to the other extreme. You've got, you know, $20,000 and you're 60. Then you are in the same position as the person who's 25 years old with $10,000. It's time to be aggressive. You need to go out there and get after it. And you need to actively trade that money. That's what I would do. With 20 grand, I would actively trade that money. I would use options the way Buffett taught us to use them, and I would create cash flow, and I would keep rolling that back into the market until I had $100,000. And once I got to $100,000, I would be putting everything above 100 into long-term portfolio, either waiting in cash or I'd be buying companies with it. And meanwhile, I would keep that 100 grand churning in aggressive investments. That part of our portfolio over the last, I think I tracked it back to 2013, has produced, and this isn't audited, but it's ballpark, you know, 27% or something a year, which isn't crazy, right? But that's actively trading stuff and taking advantage of how to do options properly. So that's pretty decent considering the ups and downs of the market and so on. And if you could do that, you will start to generate a fairly livable portfolio in a matter of a few years, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Start to really get to your 70s, you might want to slow down a little bit, but 10 years of that with 20 grand, oh yeah, you could be sitting on, you know, 100,000 in your trading portfolio and another 100,000 that you've got in the long portfolio, and you start to have a potential for a life along with Social Security and so on.
You talked about bad debt versus good debt. Can you just clarify for the listeners what you mean? What's considered good debt? Is a personal line of credit a good debt? Like what's considered good debt versus bad debt?
So there's two major characterizations for good debt versus bad debt. The first one is the interest rate, right? So terrible debt would be you miss a payment on your credit card, now your interest rate's 20%. That's just horrendous debt. You got to get out away from those. I mean, think about what that means. If I could teach you to invest and you would go out and do very well and get the minimum acceptable returns, you're making 15% a year while you're paying 20% a year on your credit card. So the first thing you got to do is get out of that bad debt, right? The second kind of bad debt is buying stuff you don't need to impress people you don't like. And that is really horrible. And we all do it. You know, we all do it, right? And at some point in time, you go get the car. Or at some point, I remember the first time I started making real money as an investor, I went out and bought a Jaguar. And you know, after a while, I started to realize this is, nobody thinks I'm cool.
Nobody cares.
Shocking, right? So you realize that you really may not need to buy a lot of the stuff we buy. You don't maybe need to do that. And I think if you maybe take some lessons from Dave Ramsey and his organization to learn to budget properly. And really hold the line, right? If you're paying $400 every 2 weeks for food, then you go through the $400, you're done buying groceries, okay? Eat what's on the shelf like we used to in college, right? So you just have a more disciplined life, and that discipline provides you with extra capital to invest. And as I said, every $2,500, you're looking at a potential $2 or $3 million in an order of a lifetime. So if you can aggressively add to that and start making money at 15, 20% a year, man, financial independence is within reach in a decade or so.
So and personal lines of credit consider good debt, depending on the interest rate, I guess.
And on the interest rate. So if you can get, let's say that you're very confident as an investor and that you have a good watch list of companies and you could refinance your house right now. Let's say you've got a 4.5% loan right now. You could refinance it at 2.75. Drop your monthly payments and you would end up maybe putting $1,000 a month away extra. And that $12,000 a year, compounding at 15% a year, starts to become a fortune in a matter of a decade. So you could see that you could convert your house equity into a potential fortune without taking a great deal of risk, right? I mean, 2.5% is almost free money.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say be careful about the interest rates. And I would also say have an emergency fund, but recognize that your investing portfolio, part of that's often in cash, that can be your emergency fund. You can pull money out of stocks instantly, and that can be your emergency fund. It's not locked up in something forever. So I'm about getting aggressive. If you want to be financially independent, I love the idea about being aggressive about it and saving every penny. I mean, when I first started, Jason, I was used to living out of a waterproof bag that we used in the Grand Canyon. It was about, 18 inches high and a couple feet wide. That's all I had. Everything was in there, pair of pants, extra pair of shoes.
Compounded that into a ranch.
Exactly what happened. And it's not rocket science. It's a matter of keeping the belt tight and, holding on. And there's an old story about Warren Buffett, these guys told who were in the insurance industry and in the same building he's in Omaha. And he got on the elevator with them and they noticed him looking at the floor and they looked down and this guy said, I looked down, there's a penny down there. I'm seeing Buffett looking at this penny. And so we all stood there watching Buffett look at the penny and he gets to his floor. Buffett gets out and then the door hasn't closed yet. And he looks at everybody and he reaches back into the elevator and grabs the penny. And then as the door is closing, he goes, beginning of the next billion. And that really becomes the attitude, and it becomes the attitude for not only you, but also your partner and your children. When you start to teach this stuff, this generational idea of generational wealth starts to become really something real. And when you start making 15% a year, saving money becomes real. When you're making 0.1% a year on it in your savings account, it's not real. It's just like, what am I doing that for? I might as well buy something. So kids start to become, misers when they start to learn this stuff. I mean, my daughter that I taught, I wrote that book Invested about her journey to learn this stuff. She's become a miser. I mean, she won't spend money. She won't come visit me. She says, you buy the ticket, Dad. I'll be over there next week.
A lot of the listeners listening right now, they're either starting their business, they're growing their business. They may not have access to a ton of free cash flow to go invest. If you don't have a lot of money, we're talking the $5,000 to $10,000 range now. Do you believe they should still start investing and enter the market now? And if so, how do you start?
I think you start by learning, and I don't think there's any minimum to start with. I started with $1,000 because when you learn to do this, it can become its own thing. I mean, it can become really its own thing for somebody that's creating their own business, right? Getting started. You're really living a full-time job, right? Oh, one of the guys that does this kind of investing is Ed Thorpe, who worked as a professor of mathematics. He went to University of California, Irvine in Cal, and had a full-time job, professor of mathematics, and also was investing on the side. So he's, as busy as anybody gets in their main job. Investing on the side doesn't take a lot of time. It kind of becomes a useful hobby. Another guy that's really good, Michael Burry, is the character in the Big Short movie, right? Played by, I forget the actor's name that played him. But former Batman guy and all that. That guy beating on the drums and everything. That's Michael Burry. Well, he invested as a hobby while he was going to Stanford Medical School, I mean, that's, you're pretty busy at medical school. Last time I checked, probably busier than any of our entrepreneurs that are sitting out there right now. People, I mean, our daughter went to medical school, and I can tell you, she worked harder than I ever worked as an entrepreneur. So there's always time to invest. It's just a question of learning to do it. And then here's the bigger picture that I wanted to tell you is that if you were to become a pretty good investor, that is somebody that could demonstrate they can make 15% a year, you could do what these guys did, which is when people found out they could make 15% a year, people said, hey, man, invest for me. And they did. And they took 25% of the profits. And that's how these guys got really rich. It's like, you didn't get rich going to medical school. You didn't even become a doctor. You just quit after medical school because he was having such an incredibly lucrative and fun time being an investor with other people's money. And that is the coolest thing in the world. That's what happened to me. And I, you know, for 5 years, I invested other people's money. And then I had enough by taking a piece of the profit that I had enough money for me to just invest on my own. And I didn't have to do that anymore. So the upside is limitless. There's no religious barriers. There's no racial barriers. There's no gender barriers. There's nobody in your way. People will swim across shark-infested waters to give their money to a purple alien from the planet of Zubu if they could prove that they could make 15% a year. It's just one of those things where if you can prove it, you will have no problem having a very nice living in your life. I can promise you that. So as an entrepreneur, you get started and you start to get the idea that everything is riding on this business that I'm doing. It might be a good idea to think that, you know what, if I learn how to invest properly, the very rules of finding a business to invest in, what make a business wonderful, the things I'm looking for as an investor, are what I should be doing in my business that I'm building. And if I'm doing that, then I'm building a better business. And if I know that, then I can invest in other people's companies, even if it's only just a few bucks, even if it's only paper trading, to just start to build that track record that other people could look at and say, hey, man, you're good at this. You're making 15% a year. And that's exactly what happened to me. And the money just comes rolling in. It's just amazing.
Bill, thank you so much for your time. By the way, it's Christian Bale.
Christian Bale. Exactly. Christian Bale.
How can the listeners learn more? I know you do a lot of in-person events, but given that we're in a pandemic going on right now, what do you have going on? Do you have any events planned? Do you have any workshops going on?
We did. We shifted to digital, and it's been something I've been wanting to do for a long time, and I just didn't know if people would be willing to accept it. But the pandemic has given people both the time and the encouragement to see if they could learn online. And so we do these live online workshops about once a month or so. You can go over to our website, Rule One Investing, just R-U-L-E-O-N-E, investing.com, and kind of just click on the button for the workshop. And you can see a lot about what we do there, and some tools are there for you to learn about and see what the people are saying who go to the workshop. I don't know if you guys know NPS scores, but a lot of entrepreneurs use, you know, the net promoter score idea of judging whether the product is good or not and if it can be improved. Our net promoter score is averaging 87, which if you know, is above Apple, above Google. I mean, it's there with Peloton. So it's a great workshop, and it lasts 2.5 days. We don't charge much for it. We just want you in there, and we do it live. We have over 250 support staff working to help you learn in small groups how to do this kind of stuff. So yeah, come on and join us.
Phil, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. After 15 years of listening to you from afar, it's really good to finally get to chat with you in person.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for paying attention and tuning into that episode. If you enjoyed it, please do me a favor, go leave a 5-star review, leave a review, leave some comments, share it with some friends, spread the love. It would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for your attention and for tuning in, and I will see you on the next episode.